The last word on Today FM with Matt Cooper.
The State of Trump's Union is our major 10-part series for The Last Word on Today FM and on podcast, which we started at the end of August and which we'll complete just before November's presidential election, on air every Monday after 6pm. Now, in each edition, we're taking time to talk to people with intelligent and informed and differing views about the United States and where it is now, politically, culturally, socially, economically, its place in the world, where there are divisions and where there's unity, the dangers it's facing, the hopes our guests have for the country's future, where power lies and how it is used. Now today I'm delighted a voice you know very well on this programme, that of the US-based Irish sports journalist and author Dave Hannigan is with us. Dave is resident now in the United States for 20 years, making him a 21st century immigrant. I want to talk to him a little bit later about the cultural role of sport in 21st century United States of America. But Dave, thank you for joining us. I want to start, though. I know you're in regular touch with people back here in Ireland via social media, via phone calls, visit homes. But what do you think of the assumptions that Irish people make about America at present and its politics?
Well, I think what I've learned over the last 20 years from being here is that a lot of people in Ireland seem to think that they know what's going on in America and can tell us and can analyze it from, you know, sitting from a position in Dublin or Cork or wherever, in a way that baffles me. You know, I'm living here, I can't even understand the country. Yet you have people in Dublin, especially around election time, will tell me why America's voting this way or why America's voting that way. And I guess it's because of access now through cable news and satellite television that they have access to all the American channels. And that, you know, gives them license and makes people feel, I think, qualified to talk about America in a way that, you know, for instance, I'm 20 years gone out of Ireland. I would never try to tell you why Sinn Féin did well or why Fianna Fáil did badly, because I don't understand that. I may pay attention to it, I may dip in and out of it, but I'm not qualified to explain what happens in Irish politics. But I think with American politics and with American society, everybody feels a sense of ownership of that. I guess it's because of the prevalence of American, you know, television and movie culture, that everybody feels a certain ownership of the American situation and thereby are entitled to comment on it.
And what do you make of the fact that nearly everybody back here in Ireland seems to lean Democrat and assume that if you're Irish American, you're anti-Republican, and with some small exceptions, are almost united in their abhorrence of Donald Trump?
What's interesting about that is you know, the Trump you see, the Trump situation makes it more difficult to analyze because he is so abhorrent. I mean, even Republican friends of mine will agree on that he is, you know, he is a special case. I mean, this is not politics as normal. This is not an ideological divide. But I have always found it odd that you're like, the media in Ireland. I mean, I worked in the media in Ireland, so I think I'm qualified to say that, is absolutely, you know, Democrat, left, you know, leading Democrat, the long love affair with the Clintons, all that kind of stuff. And it always struck me as odd that they didn't understand that there were plenty of Irish here who were Republican, you know, who were Republican for various reasons, for many different reasons, you know, even going down to, you know, people I know vote Republican because their local politician is a Republican who does them favors, in the same way that people in Kerry vote Jackie Healy-Rae and the rest of us go, how could they do that? But they do it because he's their man. He looks after them. So, yes, it is there. You know, there is a kind of a Democrat bias, I think, inherent in almost all Irish media for a long, long time. And that predates, you know, I remember I flew home to Ireland the night of the Gore-Bush election. I happened to be on a plane back to Ireland. And as the plane landed, the captain announced that Hillary Clinton had won the Senate seat for New York. And it was like, everyone's like, what an achievement. And I'm like, they've read Democrats could run anybody in New York. It's just, they could run a chair in New York. You know, it's no achievement at all, really. And then, you know, RTE News that night was aglow with Hillary's great victory. And I'm like, is anybody going to put this in context and say this is no achievement at all? So it is, it's a strange one. And I suppose when you live here, you know, as you get resentful, I think, of the fact that they try to tell you, you know, what's best for you and what's best for your country. And, you know, I'll give you an example. There was a social media thing went viral, some woman saying this thing like, you can't be Irish-American and this, and you can't be Irish-American and that. And you know, I was like, you can be whatever you want to be. I mean, you have the right to vote for whatever party, you know, to hold whatever view. Yes, people may think it's abhorrent and people may be appalled, but like, where did the right to actually have a view that is contrary to what the media tells you, where did that go, kind of thing?
Back here in Ireland, Dave, I suppose we've had an ever-growing separation between church and state and Catholic influence over the way people will vote, particularly when it comes to referenda and things like abortion and divorce. But is the Irish-American thing still more Catholic and more pro-life, which then navigates some people towards being Republican rather than Democrat?
I think that's a fantastic point and one that has been overlooked, I think, in analysis of why so many older Irish in America, you know, the older Irish immigrants who came here in the 50s and the 60s, and then Irish Americans second generation, they are still devoutly Catholic in a way that I suppose most people in Ireland really aren't anymore. And the whole, you know, the Republican is the pro-life party, and that's a big thing for a lot of the elderly Irish in particular, who still, you know, are devout, you know, mass goers every Sunday and stuff. And that stuff matters to them. And the Democrats are not the pro-choice party. So that would be a party that they couldn't possibly vote for. And they, you know, the interesting thing with that as well is that, you know, I suppose the mistake we have made in Ireland, or certainly I felt that was made in Irish coverage for years, was this talk about the Irish American vote or the Irish vote in America, when there's really no such thing and there hasn't been for a long, long time. You know, there's no one way the Irish are voting. Some are voting Republican and some are voting Democrat, you know, for different reasons and even economic reasons. Like the older Irish that I used to meet when I would go to watch the GA in AOH halls, you know, you'd meet a lot of the older Irish who were fascinating characters. A lot of them had to fight to get here. They went to England for a few years first, saved up the money, then came here and then served in the American military and then used the GI Bill to go to college. So they put in a lot of years to get here and to get up the ladder. And then when they did well economically, they wanted the vote for the party who were going to tax them less. You know, that's a very common thing, I think, in a lot of countries and a lot of people's voting choices, that people will vote for the party that will tax them less. And here, that is the Republican Party.
I was fascinated. 3 years ago, I think, just about 3.5 years ago, Dave, we sat in a bar in New York talking about a lot of these issues for a documentary that I was making at the time. And you were really interesting in the attitude of that older Irish generation towards the illegal Irish who came in the 1980s and 1990s, and for whom there was an enormous political lobby here in Ireland at the time, but you felt there was less sympathy towards those people from those who came before them.
Much, much, much less sympathy. I mean, when you would talk to these characters who came here through Canada, or came here through Britain, but came here legally and you know, put in the hard yards to get the foot on the ladder. And then they would talk about the Irish who came here without papers. I don't like to use the word illegal, but yes, you know, came here without papers. They would say, you know, they disobey the rules. Why do they expect to be treated differently? We all played by the rules. We all came here, you know, using the legitimate means. Why do these people expect different, you know, a different treatment? And also, I think for that older generation, I mean, they came here and they'll tell you fascinating stories about, you know, they would phone home once a month at a given time. Very often they were phoning a neighbor's house, so they were phoning a phone box in the village, you know, and that would be their only contact. They'd get letters and they came here never thinking they would get home. I mean, this was generations before cheap phone calls, never mind cheap transatlantic flight. So they had very little sympathy for people who made a conscious decision to come here, you know, by circumventing the rules and then wanted special treatment after. They did not, you know, they were not going to tolerate that, or they had very little tolerance for that.
I remember actually after that day when I met you in New York, I went up to Yonkers and met lots of Irish people who hadn't been home in 15, 20, 25 years and who were very fearful at that stage in early 2017 about the likely impact of the Trump administration, whether they would get thrown out. But it doesn't seem that the Irish have been the target of immigration reform since then from Trump, have they?
No, I mean, this is the problem, is everything with Trump, is there is a colour, or there appears to be a colour bias in the policies. I mean, the experience of, I mean, there have been some Irish, but it's a very minute number that are being persecuted by immigration in the past few years. In contrast, then, you have Hispanic families who are being tortured here. I teach at a community college. It's very often it's cheap entry way to third level education. So very often we would have Hispanic young Hispanic men and women who are their first of their families to go to college. So those people would have they'd be carrying the banner. But in the last couple of years, you know, I meet more and more students who are the sons and daughters of dreamers. The DACA, I think, is the official term for them. They came here. They were brought here illegally as kids by their parents. Okay, but they had nothing to do with that. And now they're here in this kind of legal limbo in America. But those kids are now living in houses where they move from house to house on every few days because they want to stay ahead of the immigration authorities. So I'm faced with situations where a student will come to you and say, I don't have the paper, or I'm going to be late with the paper because we had to up sticks last night and move across town to my uncle's or to our friends. And we're in their basement right now for a week. And so there is a persecution going on, but it's of people with brown skin. That's who the immigration authorities are targeting, because, of course, there is, you know, and always, I think, has been a prejudice in America's attitude towards immigration. White skinned people and English speaking people are treated much differently than people from Latin America or Central America, any Spanish speaking country.
Dave, that's shocking. That strikes me. A lot of these children who are now adults who you're teaching, they must have grown up in America, know nothing but American life, and they must be fearful that they could be sent back to countries that their parents came from, but they have little or no knowledge of and little ability to survive in if they were deported to it.
Absolutely. And you know, we've had students disappear. Like, you know, one minute the student hasn't missed a class, and then, you know, the student doesn't turn up, you email them, and you're, you know, then you alert the college authorities, and there's phone calls, and they're gone. The students disappear because they are fearful of any institution, even though we are a kind of a sanctuary institution, and that we, you know, we would not allow immigration onto our campus. They just disappear because for the reasons you mentioned, they're fearful of being stranded in America on their own without their parents, which has happened to a couple of our students, and also maybe being sent back to countries that they've never, you know, that they've never seen. I mean, we a couple of years ago, there was a not in my college, but there was a celebrated case of a college soccer player who was, you know, just about to go off and become, you know, get the next level of education as a soccer scholarship. On a soccer scholarship, when he was picked up and he was dropped back into El Salvador, a country that he left at 3 months old, and, you know, had a bright future ahead of him here. So there's lots of cases like that, and it's not just institutional either, that this prejudice or this hypocrisy. I mean, I'll give you a case of I remember being in a bank one time, and there was a lengthy queue, and the guy in front of me, and there happened to be Spanish speaking people at the top of the queue. And the guy turns around and goes, "I hate this bank. It's always full of immigrants." And I said, "Excuse me, I'm actually an immigrant." And he turns around and goes, "You know what I mean." And it's like, you know, he tolerates white English speaking immigrants, brown Spanish speaking immigrants, no. You know, so it's at every level, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
You wrote a terrific piece for the Irish Times recently about being 20 years living in the United States. Tell us a little bit about the story, please, of the football team that you played with in New York Besiktas, a team of Turkish immigrants. And tell us about the encounters with the police not long after 9/11.
Yes, those are my glory days, Matt. Manning the ramparts for New York Besiktas, to give it the correct pronunciation.
Apologies.
It was 2001, early 2002, and you know, I happened to somebody heard I played soccer, and they gave me a phone number of a guy, and I ended up playing for this team, a tremendous bunch of lads, and the Turks run the gas stations, as they call them, or the petrol stations on the Long Island Expressway. So I would end up picking up, different guys at each gas station along the way. And we'd go and play these games. And you know, sometimes we'd be in New York City, Queens, and places like that. And I remember this was shortly after Guantanamo Bay opened. And we were in a car, and there was a security checkpoint. And all the lads were Muslim. And I, you know, we never talked about that, but that I've since found that out to be the case. So there's three Turkish lads and myself, and we were stopped at a checkpoint, which was very common at that time because of 9/11 and the threat of the second wave of terrorist attacks and all that.
And were you wearing the jersey with the crest of the Islamic Star on it as well?
The crest. The Muslim Star and Crescent was over my beating heart kind of thing. Yes, and we pulled up, and I'm driving a battered Honda Civic or Honda Accord, I can't remember. Anyway, we were driving along, and this guy, or the checkpoint came, and I honestly, it was the first time I thought of it. I said, geez, here I am. You know, I don't know what these guys are. I mean, we play soccer. They seem to be a nice bunch of fellas. And then, you know, I could see they were nervous because I think they were more nervous even than I was, because their dealings with the police were probably not as friendly as mine, or as convivial as mine were. And as this guy walked towards us, you know, there was a definite, you know, level of palpitations going on in the car. And then, as luck would have it, the guy was Irish. The cop was Irish. He had a big Irish head in him. That was the first thing I noticed. And then he had the accent, like, that was west of Ireland. Like, I wasn't going to say, like, where are you from? You know, did you meet Beat Mayo? Kind of thing, you know? I didn't go there that far, but he just leans in and he saw the four shirts, and the car probably stank of sweat. There were no showers or any of that after the game. And then it was like, I gave it the whole, you know, whatever, Irish accent, like, and he was like, did you win and stuff? And then we drove off, and it was like, we'd been released from jail. And then the lads start to explain to me, like, that we are Muslim, but we're not fundamentalists, as they call it. That was their word for fundamentalists, was we're not fundamentals. So, yeah, that was my brush with, I briefly thought I'd be on a, you know, plane, a black ops plane headed to Guantanamo Bay. But joking aside, I mean, that was, for those people, that was much scarier than for me. My interactions with the police in America, because of my accent, because of the color of my skin, are always positive and always end well for me.
And just
again,
briefly,
is a different problem.
The 21st century Irish immigrant, do they still sort of all hang out in the Irish enclaves, the Irish bars? Or do you think, is there much now greater diversity of locations that they go to, circumstances they get themselves into, maybe driven more by the sort of the careers that they're following?
I think the enclaves still exist, but they're smaller. And I think the inclination of people to go to them is lesser for the reasons that you mentioned. I think a lot of immigrants coming now are white collar, upwardly mobile, and they go where work takes them. They're not going, you know, to be near, you know, the Irish pub or the Irish community and the Irish neighborhood. They're much more interested in you know, they're career driven, and they'll end up wherever they end up. The need to be near the Irish community, I think, is lessened by the fact that technology now means we're 3,000 miles away, but we have never had more ways of staying in touch with Ireland. I mean, you know, you can sit down and watch Irish television every night. You can, you know, you have access to every game on your computer. You know, you have cheap phone calls. You have WhatsApp groups. You're linked in 1,000 ways you weren't back in the old days. So that's why people, you know, people wanted to live in a neighborhood where they could go and buy an Irish newspaper, you know, in the corner store, like in Queens or in the Bronx and stuff like that. I mean, those days are gone. You know, they can read the papers and they can listen to the radio and whatever on their computer at work. So the need to be near, your own people, I think, has been lessened. And also the decisions they made are driven by what's best for their career. And thankfully, I think a lot more immigrants are coming here, you know, better qualified and ending up in really good jobs in really cool industries that take them to different corners of this country.
Colin Kaepernick, is he perhaps the most significant sporting figure of 21st century America?
I think he is in terms of his triggering. He may not. I mean, he's the guy. Whatever happens now, you know, wherever this thing goes, and I don't think any of us know for certain where sporting protest is going for the rest of 2020 and into the years thereafter. But Kaepernick taking the knee, I think, is going to be like when the history is written. That will be, you know, ground zero, year zero for this. And that will be the starting off point. I think his role these days is diminished because other people have stepped up now into the breach and they are carrying the flag. But yes, when we talk about this, this story will always start. It won't finish with Colin Kaepernick, but it will always start with
Colin Kaepernick. Remind people of it, the significance of the reason why he took the knee and then the reaction from all the way down from President Donald Trump to that.
Colin Kaepernick took the knee to protest police brutality and what he perceived to be racial injustice in America, especially in the way that police treated black people when they had interactions with them. That's, I suppose, the most simplest way of putting it. The reaction was he was vilified. He became one of the most hated figures in America. He was driven out of the NFL. I mean, I'm not an expert on the NFL, but I know that at several points in the last 3 years, Colin Kaepernick was at least in the top 20 men who could play quarterback in America. There were 32 starting jobs, and he was deemed, quote unquote, not good enough for any of them. So he was being, ostracized because of that. And that, obviously, the NFL disgraced itself in its initial treatment of him, the way that they conspired to keep him out of the game. Like I said, there are only 32 starting jobs in America at quarterback. It's an incredibly difficult job. He was at least in the top 20 at any given time in the last three years, and yet could not get a job. So it was obviously for political reasons. But what's interesting now is in the summer of 2020, as we move into autumn, is how much things have changed. The NFL has now admitted it was wrong, okay, which is a huge step. Maybe they're just being smart and being clever, but I would like to think that that's a shift in their thinking. They've absolutely destroyed this man for 3 years, but now the NFL has suddenly said we were wrong in how we treated him.
Of course, his critics say that he unnecessarily politicized sport, his sport, and also was offensive to the American national anthem. Although others said, well, it's only been a recent thing for its own political reasons that the national anthem has been played before every NFL game. But how has that now spread and mushroomed as part of the culture wars in the United States, taking in other sports as well?
Well, I'll give you, before I get to the NBA, I'll give you an example. There's a catcher in baseball called Bruce Maxwell, who played for Oakland at the time of the Kaepernick stuff starting, and he took a knee. And he was from his father was African American, his mother was white. He took a knee at the same time as Colin Kaepernick during the anthem. He was drummed out of baseball. Right, he actually ended up having a breakdown. And he had to be, he rehabilitated himself, went back to Mexico to play pro there, or went to Mexico to play professionally, and now has actually attempting a comeback with the New York Mets. But Maxwell was driven out of baseball, was a pariah in the game. That was 4 years ago. Now, baseball this summer, or when baseball restarted, baseball was front and center with Black Lives Matter, the players carrying black cloth onto the field as a symbol. You had the Mets actually walk off after 42 seconds of a game last week to protest the latest shooting in Wisconsin. So what I'm trying to get across is baseball went very quickly now from ostracizing Bruce Maxwell to now baseball. The clubs, the owners, and the players are all on board with Black Lives Matter and the need for greater racial justice. And then I suppose the market leader in the whole thing is the NBA, which is a curious league. It's different in this respect. The players run the NBA because there's only five players on a court. If you have two of the best players in the league, you have a chance of winning the title. The players realized this. In the post-Jordan era, the biggest stars realized we need more authority and we need more autonomy. And they started to arrange transfers, as we call it in Ireland, themselves. They didn't wait to be traded from club to club. They would get together with other players and say, why don't me and you go and play here in Miami together and win a title? So they circumvented the owners and they showed the owners, we have the economic power in this league. And then what has followed from that, and what we've seen the NBA do, and the NBA has done this periodically over the last few years, but especially when they stopped the playoffs last week and basically stopped playing for a couple of nights to protest what happened in Wisconsin, is they're showing we have economic power, and economic power, as we all know, translates into political power. So the likes of LeBron James and Chris Paul and all of these other megastars are now going to the owners of their club and the people running their league and saying, we want change. You got to talk to us. I mean, you had a group of basketball players in a room suddenly on conference calls with the governor of Wisconsin, on conference calls with Barack Obama. You know, these men realize that, yes, we're basketball players, but we actually can help our community. And the thing I think that's worth remembering, too, about like, oh, why are they bringing politics into sport? Years and years ago, before I even moved here, when I first started reading American sports magazines, I remember reading about a thing called Driving While Black, which was a phenomenon in which basketball players, especially, and NFL players, any black athlete would tell a story of whenever they were driving a nice car, they would be stopped by the police. And they called it Driving While Black. They would be constantly harassed by the police because what would they be doing driving a fancy car? And that, so that's like 25, nearly 30 years ago. And that was, you know, discrimination back then. So these people have grown up with that all their lives. And now I think we've reached a tipping point. We've reached a tipping point because the athletes realize we have enormous power, we have influence, and we need to start using it to good effect.
We don't have time to talk about NASCAR, which I think has been fascinating, given that it's such a white-dominated sport for middle America. But I want to finish out, Dave Hannigan, please, by asking you about your experiences with a sport that you love dearly, which is, well, what we would call football, but what the Americans call soccer. Because you've been involved not just as a player, but as a coach as well. And there's been an interesting, I suppose, socioeconomic phenomenon in relation to the growth of soccer as well, hasn't there?
There is, well, soccer is the most white, the whitest, most middle class. It's a country club sport in this country. I mean, it's a sport for upper middle class people who can spend, you know, $1,500 a year minimum having their kids play the game. The game of the people all over the world is not not the game of the people in America. But, you know, to kind of harp on themes that I was talking about earlier, nothing drives white middle-class Americans crazier than when they lose. And I witnessed a terrible incident shortly before the 2016 election when a Hispanic kid, I was watching a high school game, and a Hispanic kid scored two goals. And after the second goal went in, a parent, in a white parent from the other team, stood up in the bleachers and shouted, "Don't worry, Trump will send you home in November." And the rest of the crowd just burst out laughing. It was hilarious. You know, that was the height of wit for these people. So soccer, I love the game, as you know. I mean, I worked for you as a soccer writer many moons ago on the Sunday Tribune. But the game here at children's level, I mean, I have three kids. My eldest now is out of it, but I have two other kids still stuck in it. And it's horrendous. It's horrendous because it's so far removed from what you want the game to be about. Like, it's so about winning. It's so about money. It's really everything I despise about it. But there you go.
I know I shouldn't be laughing.
They're not so beautiful game, I suppose.
Dave Hannigan, it has been fantastic having you here on the State of Trump. Trump's Union. Really, as we expected, fantastic insight into what modern day United States is like. And thank you very much for taking the time to join us, and best wishes to you.
Thanks, Matt.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Listen live, on air, from 4:30 weekdays on Today FM.